Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the year 610, a man now known as the Prophet Muhammad had a vision in a cave near Mecca, and Islam was born. Within a single century, it exploded out of Arabia and onto Europe's doorstep. In the year 711, it roared in to Spain to stay for five centuries. It left a rich legacy of learning and a deep European allergy to the other. My guest today, historian David Levering Lewis, says the West might have been better off if Islam had conquered all of Europe. That takes some explaining. This hour On Point, when Islam came to Europe and why it matters now. Joining me now in the studio is David Levering Lewis, a historian who's won the Pulitzer Prize twice for volumes of his biography of the great African-American thinker W.E.B. Du Bois. He's a professor of history at New York University. His new book is God's Crucible, Islam and the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215. He was researching his book in Morocco on September 11th, 2001, when that day's terrorist attack gave his book what he calls an unwished-for timeliness. David Levering Lewis, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So what is it that about 9/11 that makes this history timely?
Well, from 9/11, we have in the West, and particularly in the United States, I think, taken a view that is increasingly demonizing of the Islamic world. We hear terms bandied about like the clash of civilizations, questions such as what went wrong, great disparity between the developed West and the retrograde Islamic East. To some degree, there is truth in those concerns and charges. But I thought it would be of great benefit to go back in time and look at a moment when the relationship between the world of Islam and what becomes the Occident, the world of Europe, were virtually reversed. A point in time in which the arrival of the Dar al Islam, the House of Islam, on the European continent, on the Iberian Peninsula, offered an option that is simply dazzling to contemplate. And that option was the incorporation of the European heartland within the Muslim world empire. The cliche of history is that moment occurred in 732, a few miles east of the Pyrenees at a place called Poitiers, where, as I think many of your listeners will recall from earlier excursions into history, Charles Martel, the Charles the Hammer, leading the Franks into battle, defeated the jihadists coming from what had come to be called Al-Andalus, or Muslim Spain.
The Muslims who had swept up from North Africa into what became Muslim Spain, over the Pyrenees, and into what's now France. They're only a couple hundred miles from today's Paris. What is kind of high water mark, the deepest penetration of Islam's military might.
Just so, or at least that's the story that we've become comfortable with. There are qualifications to be made there. One, that battle between the Muslims and the Franks was not, in the views of the Muslims, a major confrontation. It was rather more speed bump on the way to this great enterprise of universalizing Islam. From the point of view of the Europeans, and indeed the word itself develops from a description of that battle by a monk writing in Spain who said the Europenses prevailed.
The word Europe itself, what did that mean, Europenses?
Well, this was the noun for the people, and it was a neologism syllogism that theretofore had not existed. Mm-hmm. And so we, from that point on, have a kind of meta concept of what all these Germans who are inheriting the detritus of the Roman Empire are. They now are becoming Europenses. And so a collective noun that replaces the civitas Romanum, which had been the description of what people were.
Rome's backyard, Rome's world.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Well, so that's one view, that the defeat of the Muslims was a pivotal moment in history, one that allowed Europe to survive this incorporation. From the point of view of the Muslims, as I said, it was no big deal. No big deal, indeed, because the jihadists continue. Until 740, there were massive incursions, and in that year...
Into what is now France.
Into what is now France. And in that year came, on orders from the Grand Caliph in Damascus, mm-hmm. the most massive invasion to date. And just as it was poised on the promontory of the Pyrenees for that turning point battle that probably would have indeed accomplished what the Battle of 732 didn't, it was halted. And it was halted not because of the strength of the Franks, but because of a tax revolt within Islam itself.
So the forward advance of this entire sort of bursting out of its boundaries culture halted from within, you're saying?
Halted from within. Brakes are put on because of the shock troops of the jihad were the Berbers of North Africa. Mm-hmm. They were the front men. And they felt themselves...
The generals were Arabs, you point out, or tended
Arabs,
to be.
The Yemenis sort of
the top of the pyramid.
Syrians.
But the shock troops, the North African Berbers.
Well, mm-hmm. This was the crust, the grist of, mm-hmm. of these advances. They felt themselves pretty ill-served. They had died nobly in a great cause. They hadn't gotten the best real estate in Al-Andalus and
Spain.
In Spain, and indeed they were now being forced to do things that they felt were not part of their bargain. And that tax revolt spread to North Africa, and within a few years the reverberations of that caused an eruption in the far east of today's Iran, a province called Khorasan. So that between 740 and 750, the caliphate and the Umayyad dynasty that had been running the show mm-hmm. since the death of Muhammad mm-hmm. lost purchase on its empire, imploded, and was displaced quite violently by a new dynasty, the Abbasid, who moved the capital, the center of Islam, from Damascus to a new city built in the blink of an eye, Baghdad. And all of that meant that what's happening in Europe is a kind of breather, so that by the time the new situation coheres in the Ummah or in the House of Islam, mm-hmm. we have a Europe that is rather more ready, rather more organized.
To resist.
To resist, led by the descendants of that Charles the Hammer. Those descendants we, of course, familiarly know as the Carolingians and Charlemagne.
Charlemagne and all the rest.
Is the iconic figure representing them.
And that resistance mustering as the face and thrust of Islam changed. There's so much rich detail here that I want to get into as much as we can. But I have to note right at the beginning, because it's so arresting, you bring a kind of breathtaking impartiality to this. Now, perhaps that's the historian's role, but much history has been written
here.
Well,
it's very gratifying to hear you say that, because some reviewers have thought that I was mercilessly impartial.
You've been called a special pleader for the Muslims. I mean, when you stand impartially above this, it sounds like special pleading, because as you note, this is history that's been written from, you know, in a partisan way, maybe forever, maybe for a long time. But when you say that Europe was dazzled, that it was this dazzling Islam, I mean, they did resist. I mean, they resisted like crazy, and resistance became the overwhelming theme of Europe. So was it really so dazzling if, you know, waves of Franks and Visigoths and ultimately Saxons and you name it were ready to lay down their lives to push back against Islam? How appealing was this?
Yes, well, that's a that is a simplification of the chronology. In time, these things do happen, but history is the story of time. And as we move along the decades, it takes some time to get to this dichotomous position, or this position of total antipathy, Islam versus Christendom.
But didn't they fight right from the beginning? I mean, Spain was Visigoth. Christian. Here come the Muslims. I mean, there was resistance, though quickly overrun in Spain, in Andalusia.
The resistance has little to do with religion and culture. It has to do with territory, and it has to
do with... Somebody from outside is marching into our town.
Indeed so. And, of course, the failure of the Visigoths in Iberia is, to some extent, the result of its persecution of its... some of its own people.
The Visigoths, the Jewish population, among others.
The Jewish population. A British medievalist of the early 20th century said, you know, in the Dark Ages, there was one group that was particularly opaque, and that was the Visigoths. They seemed, he thought, to have never get a handle on statecraft. And so they had a rather brutal polity ready to crack at the seems when challenged, as happened in 711. But the triumph of the Muslims in the first century and second century does not throw up or engender great religious antipathies. Make no mistake, the standoff between Charles Martel and the Islamists from Al-Andalus was not a matter of religion. It was a matter of turf consciousness.
But those terms would come to this meeting, to this conflict. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Islam's first big impact on Europe and the West, and its echoes today with an historian who says maybe Islam should have won in its first big conflict with the West for Europe's own sake. Daniel Levering Lewis is with us, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. His new book is God's Crucible. And let's go straight to our listeners, if I may. Joe, in Gainesville, Florida, you're on the air with David Levering Lewis.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Lewis.
Hello.
I just wanted to say that the word crucible was really a very apt term for this. Even though this is a bit off topic, I wanted to take the discussion to the other side of Europe, specifically beginning with the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. Nearly 50 to 60 years later, Luther is pinning his thesis on the Church of the Wittenberg door, and how in such a small amount of time, the interactions between Islam and the West have caused such profound profound changes in Western society. And going to your point, Mr. Ashbrook, about what you just said about the relevance to Islam today, it seems that the outgoing Islam, even the outgoing Islam in terms of conquest, has led us to such a wonderful appreciation for the faith.
Who's appreciating it so wonderfully? We've got a lot of tension these days, Joe.
Yes, I agree. But what I'm trying to say is that I've never been to Spain. I mean, I've seen, you know, seen the pictures and everything, but I'm of Indian descent. When you go to New Delhi, you see these, you know, wonderful Mughal monuments, the Taj Mahal, you know, the wonderful palaces in Spain. You know, this is, in some ways, the outgoing Islam seems to be, even through conquest, what they've left us is so beautiful.
And Joe, should I mean, would Europe have been better off if Islam had swept, I don't know, right on up to the tip of Denmark?
I can't say. I think that the tension between Islam and Europe in the 16th, going all the way back to the time that Professor Lewis is writing, is in some ways far more important, because I think in many ways both civilizations benefited. Beyond just the territorial aspects that Professor Lewis was describing, you know, the need to, for example, hold territory in Spain, the tension between the two civilizations, the interaction between the two civilizations, even on a martial standpoint.
Right. Not to mention all the classics from Greek, classical civilization that were circled back, cycled back into Europe via the Islamic invasion and cultural presence there. Joe, thanks very much for your call. David Levering Lewis, there's so much. I don't know how we're going to get to all of it. I want to come back to exactly this point, but I have to ask you, do you really – I'm not sure what's the Europe that you picture if you say Europe lost 300 years, perhaps, when Islam was pushed back?
Yes.
That Islam brought Greek learning, it brought mathematics, science, culture, tolerance to Al-Andalus. But would we have had German and Dutch women in burqas today and many of the maladies we see in some of the Islamic world today in Europe? Is that something to be longed for?
I don't want to be so counterfactual that I assign myself the responsibility of answering all the various questions that flow from a reversal in history. Let me just back up and say that perhaps it's an overstatement to say that my thesis is that Europe would have been better off if it had been incorporated in the Muslim ecumene. What I really suggest is that it's important to consider the cost benefits of an outcome in history, and that I think it can be argued quite confidently that the interface of Islam and Christendom in the 8th century give us a situation of great asymmetry in which the Islamic world, with its science, with its technology, with its recuperation of the learning of classical antiquity, and above and beyond all other considerations, its robust global economy stretching from Sindh in China to Sijil Masa on the edge of the Sahara to the Atlantic Ocean, that free trade zone that Islam had created by the 8th century give us a civilization that is about 3 to 4 centuries easily in advance of the society then existing in the European heartland.
But you do say if someone had stepped down from another planet and looked at this, they might well have concluded Europe would be better off if Islam had swept right on north.
I do say that. I say that a visitor might have said that. There are, though, other considerations, and they would be not women in burqas, but the notion of the individual vis-à-vis what we call the state. The state is not a term that exists in Islam in the way that that we accept the term. But the defining aspect of Europe does seem to be that the individual has always had, historically, an uneasy and tensed relationship with both church and state. Very different situation under Islam. Those antinomies do not exist. There is no difference between individual and the group. There is no difference between state and church. The society is indeed essentially theocratic, although...
It doesn't mean there aren't political prisoners in state-run prisons in Islamic countries.
You mean currently?
Currently, or...
I suppose so, as we have Abu Ghraib. That, I think, we don't want to sort of match one...
I'm just pointing out, that looks like a kind of antagonism between the individual and the state today in some Islamic states.
Well, yes, but if you know, you leap about and cherry-pick examples of what's going on in history from the 8th century to the 21st, you muddy, I think, the issue of... what is the essential program that was being offered in one time frame that would have had a number of determinable results? And what are we dealing today with as a result of any number of things that have happened in the interim? Your caller from Orlando, makes a very good point that this systole-diastole relationship between the Islamic world and the Christian world, the back and forth has defined both civilizations. Mm-hmm. One thing is inconceivable without the other. In the 17th century, we have a tipping phenomenon. Islam makes its last attempt at incorporation and the second siege of Vienna.
To the gates of Vienna,
The gates of Vienna. That doesn't work out. It's a close-run thing, doesn't work out. And from that point on, it is Europe advancing in its crusading or in its jihad into the Islamic world, benefiting from so much of the things that were put on a conveyor belt and sent over the Pyrenees in the 11th, 10th, and 11th centuries into Europe, like science, like technology, which produces that European Renaissance that fuels the development of Europe and sends it exploring the world.
But centuries later, you say it might have come quicker so that we can savor the distinction that you're focused in no small part on here. Could you just, in historical terms, take a kind of snapshot in time to compare and contrast the Al-Andalus, the Spain under the Moors or Muslims at its height, which you hold, in, as many do, in high regard, with medieval Europe kind of on the other side of the mountains. Paint a picture of those two side by side.
Yeah, the other side of the mountain is really pretty ramshackle and tatterdemalion. It is, in fact, an economy that has no currency. It's a barter economy. It's an economy that functions on...
About beer and butter and slaves,
Well, that's a caricature, but I will...
Well, you have the list yourself here.
All right, then I'll stand by it. Thank you very much. It helps picturesquely depict that society. And it's a society based on caste, military caste. It is a society in which... the wonderful ideals of the founder of Christianity are used for purposes of dominion, and you have under Charlemagne indeed the militarization of Catholicism, so that results in a faith which says there's only one way to be a Christian, and deviancy is to be is a capital offense, and those who are not Jews, those who are not Muslims, are to be very severely dealt with. And in 1215, of course, we have the famous Fourth Lateran Council presided over by Innocent III, which just reads out of the Societas Fidelium, or out of Christendom, all the deviants.
You call it an empire carved by swords
indeed.
In what was to become Europe. But what about on the Islamic side?
On the other side,
it was only a century that it took to go from Mecca and Medina to take Syria, Egypt, North Africa, Iraq, Persia, into Spain. There was a lot of sword work involved in that expansion.
There was an enormous amount of sword work involved. It seems, however, that the success of the sword play in civil terms is a measure of the acceptability of this dominion. That is to say, what the Muslim Empire does is really replicate the Roman Empire. And what was the Roman Empire? It was a dominion in which you're free to do pretty much what you will, so long as you pay your taxes and you don't offend Roman law.
With special taxes in the Andalus case for non-Muslims.
That's quite true. That's quite true.
Describe that period that you practically adore in the mid-8th century, I guess, when the sort of high watermark of Islamic Spain.
I would choose the 9th century.
Excuse me.
Because by that time, Cordoba has become a kind of prefiguration of Paris. It is a modern city with street lamps, with pavement, with markets that flourish with the goods of the known world, price controls indeed. It is a place where... the term has not yet been coined, but it will come along. Convivencia obtains. Mm-hmm. And that is a pluralistic society in which, of course, the dominion is an Arab dominion, a Muslim dominion, but in which Jews and Catholics and others are able to live their lives and prosper, and indeed collaboratively, so that by the 10th and 11th centuries, Sephardim, or Jews, have... moved up the food chain, as it were, into positions of advice and counsel, and indeed government leadership. It is true, I think you would have to say, that the The imperative of the Quran that in religion there is no compulsion had been abided by in Al-Andalus, as indeed in Syria, as indeed in Persia. Religious tolerance was the modus operandi of this Muslim show.
So now, science, arts, technology, wealth, all there in the Muslim Andalus, and you hold that up against what you describe as what sort of fratricidal, slave-holding, backward, retarded economy you describe it.
Those words seem terribly ungenerous, but I think they also are accurate. I think they are accurate, yes.
And still, you know, I had the sense reading this, you describe all the learning that was brought here, this tolerance with its limitations, mm-hmm. but nevertheless a kind of tolerance. And, you know, we are taught and trained and educated to be open-minded. And yet your description of this history brought out the kind of home team partisanship in me. And I couldn't help feeling, what about my, I don't know, Viking and Visigoth forebears? I mean, who would want to be conquered in any time, in any place?
You're quite right. And isn't that to fast forward to today and those examples of tyranny and religious intolerance and savagery that manifest themselves in parts of the Islamic world? Isn't the source of those things the invasion or the perception that a society has been overwhelmed and wrongly dealt with and that therefore people are left no choice, they feel, but to reach for things that will justify their resistance? And of course, as I think you would agree, Tom, scripture is awfully plastic, whether it's Christian or Buddhist or Zoroastrian. We read into it what we need, and we reach for our better selves when we feel really quite noble and secure. And then, of course, the Gospels are Gospels of milk and kindness. If, on the other hand, we are threatened and people have come into our hearts and we've been described as axes of evil, why then we justify our resistance in terms of violence and intolerance. This happened in Islam in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, after the fall of Toledo in 1085, Muslims there began to reach for their scripture and reach for their fundamentals as they were opposed by the invading Christians.
We have so many listeners who want to get in here. Let me go to Yassine calling from Boston. Hi, Yassine, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to weigh in on this conversation. I agree with the author because, well, first of all, my background is Moroccan, and my family comes from Andalusia. They left Spain around 1250,
yes.
And we went to Morocco. When we were there, I mean, I just want to weigh in because they had the best scientific research was going on before 1250. Then they had they had a good irrigation system going on. They had good education. They had good healthcare. I mean, when the Muslims were in Spain, Spain was on the top of its shine in Europe. And this one, I say again, then after they left, the Muslims left, Europe took a start from what the Muslims had left from science books and all the research and took off from that point. And that's what created this powerful Europe that you see today in 2008. This is the leftover from what the Muslims had left. And just one more thing I want to add is just when the Muslims had left, they asked everybody the non-Christian faith to leave, including the Jewish, and the Jewish people had left Spain and went to Morocco, and they lived with us until today.
And
I wanted to add that.
And we can hear all these centuries later a kind of nostalgia for that time, Yassine, in what's been handed down in your family. Thank you for that call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Islam's first big impact on Europe and the West and its echoes today with an historian who says maybe Islam should have won in its first big conflict with the West for Europe's own good. My guest is David Levering Lewis, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, professor of history at New York University. His new book, Provocative Thesis, Controversial, God's Crucible, Islam, and the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215. I'll tell you, it's a heck of a good read. This was very dramatic time, great stakes, and lots of resonance right now. In just a moment, we'll be joined from Paris by Christopher Dickey, who knows the Middle East well and is watching Europe deal with Islam today. But first, let's take a call from Heather in Amherst, Massachusetts. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, David. This is Heather White. How are you?
Holding up.
Well, thank you for writing another big book.
Oh, hello, Heather. Yes.
Yes, you know me.
Yes, I do. Nice to hear from you indeed.
Yes, I want to go back to the question Tom raised just briefly about what the status of women might be today had Islam prevailed over Europe in the 8th and 9th centuries, because currently Islamic women, as you know, throughout the world are often relying on Europe and the U.S. for protection, and in hundreds of cases annually asylum from oppressive cultural traditions that sanction forced marriages, honor killings, genital mutilation, etc. And, you know, based on what you've said so far, I'd have to say as a female in the 21st century, I'll take a retarded economy any day over Sharia laws.
Yes, I think...
thank you very much, David.
It's not a pretty period. I would just say that genital mutilation is not part of an Islamic requirement at all. But Hirsi Ali, of course, has made that issue an issue that is, of course, important and urgent.
The Somali exile who's raised it very much and who has pinned it on Islam's responsibility.
Yes, but there's no imperative in Islam for that sort of thing. This is a most complicated and fraught issue. To say this, that from the beginning, the Quran is, it seems, moderately ahead of the other scriptures in terms of the rights it vouchsafes women.
Ahead, you say, of the Judaic and Christian tradition, but isn't the proof in the pudding, ultimately?
Well, it becomes evident soon thereafter that this patriarchal society is having none of the injunctions, proto-feminist injunctions embedded in the Quran, and it is interpreted in ways that increasingly deny women rights, and they are marginalized in terms of their civic prowess. That's quite true. And on the other side of the Pyrenees, in benighted Carolingian Europe, one has to concede...
Charlemagne and Charles Martel's Europe, yeah.
You have to concede that the rights of women, because of property laws and considerations, are enhanced. The absence of polygamy is, of course, a good start, a starting point for the way in which the family emerges and the rights of women emerge in the family. I think I would have to agree with Heather Knight that as a male, I would want to meet women who benefited from the West's evolved respect for the rights of women.
That's half the population. Does that put a damper on your enthusiasm for the, you know, if we roll the tape back and it had gone the other way, that's a big part of the population to sort of send off into Burqa land.
Well, of course, that part of the population has been sent off historically until about the 19th century. So this is a battle that both sides cannot acquit themselves well in until of recent time. And that difference, of course, is greatly enhanced by the breakthroughs in science and technology and the rights of women to control their own bodies in a way that historically was not available anywhere. That has not spilled over into Islam to the degree that it should have, has to do, though, with the retardation of Islam now. And that retardation is economic. The unemployment of males in the Islamic world is off the chart, 60%, 70%, depending on the economic demographics of the region. Those unemployed and underemployed people, males disproportionately, find their life chances obstructed by sclerotic regimes perceived to be supported handsomely by the United States, Egyptian and others, where the $5 billion annual subsidy prevents the Egyptian society from having elections that are in any way authentic.
And women suffering in the backwash of that, you suggest, but there remains a kind of patriarchal impulse driving as well. Heather, thank you for your
call.
That
patriarchal impulse we've seen a bit in, of course, American politics of late with family values, which has been a code for repression of women, one would suggest.
Yes, nevertheless, pick your gender and pick your preference for where you'd like to be dropped, and we'll see how people might choose. I want to go to Paris. Christopher Dickey has been good enough to join us for a moment. Newsweek's Paris Bureau Chief, Middle East Regional Editor, reports on politics, the economy, society in Europe and the Middle East. Christopher Dickey, it's always wonderful to speak with you, and we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, my pleasure, Tom. It's really been a pleasure listening to Professor Lewis as well.
Thank you.
Here we've got a brilliant Pulitzer Prize-winning historian moving onto this turf with a kind of provocative suggestion, and I just wonder how it sounds to someone sitting in Paris, just a couple hundred miles from Poitiers, where the kind of, in our common understanding of history, the tide was turned back. David Levering Lewis suggesting that Europe might have been better off if Islam had swept on north and east. How do you reckon that sounds?
I think if we reduce it to that catchphrase, what it sounds is, the way it sounds is dangerous.
Quite.
Mainly because one of the things that's standing in the way of a lot of the advancement of Muslim society right now, both in the Muslim, what we think of as the Muslim world, and in Europe, is a kind of fatal nostalgia for the days of Andalusia. I mean, there is no mistake that Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri and the leaders of al-Qaeda like to portray themselves as knights under the Prophet's banner, expanding the empire, and they love to talk about the glories of al-Andalus. And I think that there is a certain sort of danger here when we say, sort of casually, and I don't think this is what the professor is saying, that Europe would be better off if the conquest had continued after Poitiers, or if it hadn't been arrested in 740 by internal strife. That is really a problematic issue in terms of the way modern Muslims try and think of themselves, because it's not just an idea that says that we had a glorious history. It's an idea of that glorious history juxtaposed with what's seen as hundreds and hundreds of years of colonization and repression, and that's part of what feeds radicalism in Muslim societies all over the world right now.
Christopher Dickey, what about, though, the boatload of cultural treasures that Islam brought to Europe today, as Europe wrestles?
Those are undeniable, but I think I don't know if the professor goes into this because I think he's concentrating on Al-Andalus.
Actually, not
flowering of culture. The real flowering of culture that I think is interesting was in Venice, where you had a real juxtaposition of the East and the West mainly through commerce. Yes, there were wars. Yes, there were naval battles, but you had a tremendous blending of the cultures of the Islamic world and the European world that gave us the sort of glories of Venice in the 14th and 15th century.
I couldn't agree more. There was a wonderful show at the Metropolitan quite recently about just that fruitful interaction. It was really quite glorious. I do end my book. One ends at I end at 12:15, and the fertilization that you mentioned comes later. But that is a wonderful example of that, as would be Sicily, where the interaction between Christendom and Islam fruitfully goes on, and gloriously so, and is reflected in the Frederick Hohenstaufen's attempt to combine the faiths. Also, there is a lot in this book, and it does spend a good deal of its time on the other side of the Pyrenees, and it deals with with Italy, and it deals with Gaul, and it shows the painstaking way in which that society assembled itself in reaction to and benefiting from the phenomenon across the Pyrenees. I try to make it nuanced, but in the gallop of an interview, of course, as one explains oneself, one stumbles into a certain amount of reductionism, which makes it a little more catastrophically antithetical or different or bizarre than I think the read itself.
It's unavoidable, and we acknowledge that fully. But it does come down. I mean, you describe them being shaped or shaping themselves in response to stimulus from Islam. On the other hand, I mean, we come down to this at the end. You talk about Western Europe institutionalizing the view of folks outside their ken, outside their realm, with an unassimilable otherness that still, in your view, haunts relations between these civilizations today.
Quite so, yes. I would stand by that. And that, I found that's why I rode hard that horse of the Song of Roland and the great standoff or reversal on the top of the Pyrenees when Charlemagne attempts to invade Spain. And in the ambush of the knights as they leave, we have the great constitutive myth of European culture, the Chanson de Roland.
Song of Roland.
In which the otherness of Islam is deeply embedded. It is to be a war forever, says Turoldus, the author, presumed author of the Song of Roland. And that alterity, that it's them and it's us, it's embedded early on. But it is not a clash of civilizations overnight. It takes a lot of time. They have to work at it before they decide that they are unassimilably to be opposed throughout time.
Christopher Dickey, we've just got you for another minute. Can we untangle that knot, do you think, by going back in history? Does it help us to go back and revisit this?
I think we can if the professor feels up to writing a sequel. I think one of the things to look at is the way the Muslim world essentially missed the first great information revolution, when it basically did not adopt movable type in the printing press in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, even into the 18th and 19th centuries. Large parts of the Muslim world didn't have ready access to printing presses.
Oh, that's quite
a result. It missed the information revolution.
That's a very good point, Christopher. And that Metropolitan show I was just mentioning, it has the Bible, it has the Bibles, it has the Qurans that were printed by Venetian businessmen with a view to being distributed at good, cheap cost to throughout the Ottoman Empire. And of course, the reaction of Muslims was horror. My goodness! So that was just an example of this information revolution that there was not much receptivity to, in large part because you had structures that didn't want change, not so much to do with Islam, but to do with the way the society had constituted itself. Mm-hmm.
Christopher Dickey with Newsweek in Paris, we wish we had you all day, and perhaps if Professor Levering Lewis writes a sequel, we'll arrange that. Thank you so much for being with us from Paris today.
Thank you.
Let me get one
Thank
more call
indeed.
From Les in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Les. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Professor Lewis.
Hello.
I was going to talk a little bit about toleration, because oftentimes Islam is presented as being somehow inherently more tolerant, at least in its nascent stages. And I question this premise, not so much because there was toleration, of course, but I see it more as a pragmatic necessity. The Arabs were generally uncivilized in the beginnings, and they were conquering lands that were much more civilized than they, and that were overwhelmingly non-Islamic. And so it was a pragmatic necessity that they be tolerant. I mean, they'd conquered Christian Egypt, Christian Syria, and these places were much, much more civilized than they.
Les, our time is so short, with regret, let me take it right there and put this question, because this tolerance, convivencia, the word that came out of Andalus, you hear less questioning whether this was endemic to Islam.
It was certainly in accord with the prescriptions of the Quran, but also it was pragmatic, indeed so. And your caller makes a very good point that they were smart enough to realize that they couldn't preside over this new world empire constituted in the blink of an eye unless, indeed, they gave lots of margin of maneuver to the subject populations, and that they did. It was a lesson the Romans taught them. An example, though, of this deficit in in culture that you impute to the Arabs, there's a famous statement in the great text of the Persians, the Salome by Ferdowsi, and it is, curse these times, curse this age, curse my fate that uncivilized Muslims have, Arabs, uncivilized Arabs have come to make me a Muslim. But of course, soon the Iranian Empire will be an integral part of the Dar al-Islam.
David Levering Lewis, there's no way we're going to get to all the splendors that you walk us through in this book, the architecture of the great mosque and the science of ancient Greece brought back, the numerical system of South Asia and India that was brought to Europe and everything that helped unloosed. I think we're going
Plato
to have to...
Plato and Euclid.
Plato, Euclid, you name it. It's unbelievable. I think for today we're going to have to just be titillated and hope for more time and more from you at another point. It's provocative. It makes us think about where we stand and what we stand on in history. And for that, we're always grateful. The new book is God's Crucible, Islam and the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215. I hope you'll come again. I've got about 100,000 more questions. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hold them. I'll be back.
Okay, great. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Ping Wong and Chelsea Mers, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.